Hey, Boss Lady, what are you doing to make a difference for women? I'm Andrea Gickline.
And I'm Christy Atwater. Our guest on Hey, Boss Lady is Dr. Hannah Valentine, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at Stanford University.
Her specialty is in heart transplants. I would say her story is heartwarming, and it is, but it is also so much more than that. It's making a difference for women and people of color in the workplace and in the practice of medicine.
In fact, Dr. Valentine was recently elected into the National Academy of Medicine for her work. Isn't that awesome?
That is incredible.
That's one of the highest recognitions you can get as a scientist and a physician. We'll meet Hannah in a minute, but first, Andrea, let's talk about how you were connected to her.
Well, this is really cool, especially for Hey Boss Lady and everything that we're trying to bring out about women needing to be seen and heard for the great accomplishments. A very dear friend of mine, Jennifer Schroeder, was listening to our first episodes, came to me and said, Andrea, I know a woman whose life work and her enthusiasm for both the equity and in the medicine to actually making sure people of color are recognized. You will love her and you have to meet her. And I did.
Well, that's so awesome. So let's bring in Dr. Valentine. Dr. Valentine, would you mind if we call you Hannah?
Not at all. Please do call me Hannah.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
You're doing so many things, and you've done so many things, it's hard to know where to start. But how about if we start with a quote from you, which you shared with our producer? And I'm so interested to hear what you have to say about this. We can't be successful by just telling women to go for it. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, this is to do with the fact that women can do a lot. They have been successful. But there are certain barriers and challenges that prevent them from actually achieving their goals and moving into leadership positions where they can actually change the world. And in order to be able to do that, others have to change. The structures in which our organizations work that were developed and designed by men for men a century ago, still exist.
Wow.
So we can't just say, you know, you got to lean in. Yes,
right.
We have to lean in. But at the same time, we have to be doing that deep work to change the cultures of these organizations in which we work.
You know, that's really incredible, Hannah. Knowing that you have such a long career already, tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing right now. I know that you're a cardiologist and you're a professor of medicine at Stanford University. You're actually what's known as a physician scientist. Is that correct?
That is correct. And throughout my career, I have hung on to doing the work as a physician scientist. That means looking after patients as well as doing the research that will ultimately solve the problems that I see in my patients every day. And a second area, which is to do with this enhancing the diversity in the scientific workforce, which is critically important for getting the best work done in terms of making sure that people's health are the very best. Without that diversity of the doctors, the scientists, the nurses themselves, we will be falling short of actually doing our best for everyone in our society. So my work is twofold. Firstly, I do research, and my research has always focused on how we can manage patients who've had organ transplants, especially heart transplants, so that that transplanted organ can survive for the longest period of life and give this person a real shot at a full and normal lifestyle. And to do that, we have to do this research. Yeah.
You know, I know that your work with transplants is so important because when you and I chatted, I shared with you that just recently, within the last month and a half, we lost a son and his organs were donated, and the ability to know in our hearts that that person not only got the organ, but that they would survive, really touched me about your work.
Yes, and my work throughout my career has been trying to figure out how best we can make sure that our patients who get these transplanted organs live really full lives and long lives, and that the organ really survives. And but the tests and the ways that we monitor them in terms of rejection is often scary to them. So, for example, when you've had a heart transplant, you got to have these heart biopsies on a regular basis.
Ooh.
And the poor patients are really afraid of them, of having them. They feel that this is going to damage their heart. And one patient of mine actually said, Dr. Valentine, look, first you give me a heart, and then you take it away bit by bit with your heart biopsy.
Wow.
Is there not a better way of doing this? And the answer is yes. Finally, we have a test that I invented with some colleagues at Stanford a few years back that is now replacing this heart biopsy.
I will tell you that Christy has got a question she is dying to ask you, and it actually is almost the real life version of the heart work you do. And it has to do with gender equity and racial equity. So let's pause on your discovery, which is incredible.
Yes. Again, we need to emphasize the awesomeness of what you just talked about, because I'm a little shell-shocked by it. But it must really give you great feelings of accomplishment, and we thank you for that. You've been working on issues of gender and racial equality in the workplace and in practice of medicine for most of your career. And I don't think every doctor or every physician has done that in the past. So what do you see as the biggest challenge on that front today?
Yeah, that's a great question. The work that I've done on ensuring that women and other racial ethnic groups get represented in science and medicine has a number of aspects to it. One is that we've got to make sure that we recruit women into these positions very early on, and that we advance them. And to do that, it means giving women the skill sets, but also changing those situations of bias and discrimination and inequalities that really turn people off. So there are many instances where women can come into a particular area as a physician, as a surgeon, and they find that the culture is so negative that they turn away and go and do something else.
Yeah.
So the answer to your question of what are those barriers, that lies in the culture. The cultures that really are not supportive and inclusive. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that when you enter a certain field and you're in it, and you need to be advanced, you can feel biases and discrimination against you simply even in the words people use.
Mm-hmm.
Before, you can feel it in the interview situation.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel it by looking at, you know, who gets selected for what.
Yes.
And you
yes.
can actually see it by who is in those leadership positions.
Hannah, you work for you've worked for a number of iconic institutions, the NIH and Stanford University. I know that you've been really working hard on this topic, addressing gender disparity in the workplace and specifically at Stanford. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe personally why it was of interest, what it was that you set out to do and how to solve it?
Yeah. So the first time that I ever felt a sense of not belonging, of isolation, was when my family moved from the Gambia when I was 13, where I was part of a majority group, and we moved to London, where I found myself in a high school of 500 students, and me being the only student of color. And so that feeling of not belonging, of being inferior, really was very intense, such that my academics suffered then. So that that was the beginning of it. And I think once I recovered from all of it, I put it to one side. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later, as the Senior Associate Dean for Diversity and Leadership, that I began this work. And I took this work in several directions. I wanted to make sure that we recruited enough women and various racial ethnic groups mm-hmm. into Stanford Medicine right. as faculty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to be sure that we recruited enough women into leadership positions, because if you looked at the evidence then, there were, you know, at least sort of 35% of women doctors at entry level
right.
at Stanford. But when you looked at the leadership position, it was less than 10% women.
Wow.
And I proposed a provocative goal for leadership
I love it.
In 2010. And that goal was 50-50 by 2020. And I wrote an article about 50-50 by 2020 and how we were to get there. And I will be honest with you, it was rather tongue-in-cheek, because I had no idea that we would get there. But you know what?
Yes.
Stanford has already gotten there.
Fabulous. Wow. You know that's what we were going to ask. Yes.
Yeah. In this short period of time of about 6 or 7 years, they've gone to almost 50% women as department chairs. Now, department chairs are one of the highest level of leadership.
Wow.
So now we've got, it's actually 47% of the department chairs. There are about 30 departments at Stanford. There are women. And this is in stark contrast to all of those top universities out there.
Yes.
Where mostly they are at 20%.
Right.
Yes,
women
that's...
for their depression. It is remarkable.
Remarkable.
And so I had
congratulations.
To write a follow-up article, which was published last October in Academic Medicine, showing how we had got there, but pointing out that there's still more to do. We need to do as well as that for racial and ethnic groups like Blacks, Hispanics, Native American, to boost their representation
Absolutely.
In academic medicine.
Now, because I cut you off at the beginning when you were going into your research, and there was a reason. The research and your most current accomplishments that you were about to tell us about that are so incredible in medicine, I wanted to juxtaposition to make sure that we really understood what was going on in the institution, and then this research that you have been able, even up against everything that you were focused on with diversity, this incredible research that you have brought to life with others, physician scientist. Can you take us back to that?
Yes. So what I was talking about was the need to make the drive to actually make sure that patients who have had a heart transplant are well cared for, don't reject their heart. If they're rejecting, it's diagnosed early and they're treated. And the fear that patients have of getting a heart biopsy, which is a highly invasive procedure that you put a catheter right into the internal areas of the heart and take a tiny piece of muscle, scary, scary. And so I wanted to develop a blood test, a simple blood test. In a way, it's very similar to prenatal diagnosis. I'm sure you've heard about this. Mm-hmm. You know, women like myself, being pregnant, would have to have what was called an amniocentesis.
Right.
To take blood from the baby to make sure they didn't have genetic abnormalities. But now that is done by simply taking a blood test. So this is exactly the same principle.
Wow.
And so when I found that there was a person, a scientist at Stanford in 2010 who had developed a test like that for prenatal diagnosis, I immediately called him up and said, wow, this is for pregnant women, but do you think it will work in for heart transplants? And he said to me, his name is Steve Quake, he said, well, yes, I think it will work because after all, the transplanted heart is a genome transplant.
Right.
So I had some blood that was stored from a previous research study. We did the testing, and guess what? It worked. And now we have a blood test that's been licensed, and patients are having that blood test instead of these horrible biopsies.
Yes,
that they've
that's
been
amazing.
Terrified. Yeah, so that's it.
Yeah,
Hannah, I want to know, because you seem so progressive in the medical field, but then also relating to gender and racial equality, have you ever faced resistance or adversity to your ideas or suggestion? Because they do seem very progressive, and I'm glad you're brave enough to bring them forward, but I'm just wondering if there's ever been any resistance or adversity to your ideas and how you handled it.
Yeah, that's a great question. All of my life has been pushing against barriers and addressing challenging problems. And so when we look at women and the representation of women, tons of barriers, of course.
Right.
You know, people would say things like, ooh, you know, we're just selecting the best. And if we want to consider diversity, are we going to substitute that for excellence? Oh, my God.
Oh.
You know, that would
yes.
be really annoying to hear. And I will tell you that nowadays people are gone underground, so to speak. They don't actually say
right.
those words anymore,
right.
but they automatically still think them.
Yes.
If you do these bias tests, you'll
yes.
figure out that people have these biases still.
Yes.
Right.
And now the challenge is how to get people to make different decisions, even though they have these biases. And that's what I'm working on right now.
And, you know, that's really incredible because as you spoke, I heard so many things. The cultural male-dominated environment and how you had to come up against that. The combination of your work is just, you know, is startling to see how you've combined the two. So where we sit at this moment is lots is changing. Yes, they've gone underground. But in the things that you know that are in place at this moment, what do you see is getting better?
I think the sheer numbers of representation of women mm-hmm. in leadership positions is getting better. And from what we know about women in leadership positions, that will spill down to lower levels, and that will make this transformation of the culture that we want to take shape more likely to occur when we have these women in the leadership positions. We will have more recognition of the need for work-life integration, childcare, which is a real hot button in the context of COVID-19 and women's careers. And so I think that's working. And we've got to do more. What else is working? There is a greater recognition of the power of bias, and especially unconscious bias. And there is a lot of training being developed, including some of what I've developed, to overcome these biases as we make these decisions as to who gets hired, what salary do people get, is there equity? And I think that is working, and again, but needs more work. One last area, which I think is not yet in place, but people are thinking about it, is how we reward those behaviors that we want people to adopt that will lead to this culture of inclusion. What do I mean by that? You know, we all go to work. We get paid for seeing our patients. We get paid for doing our research. We get paid for teaching. But how much support is there is there for people doing this work on diversity and inclusion?
Right.
Not much.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's like an added burden, an added piece of work to your already full workload.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's called the diversity tax. And it doesn't get rewarded and recognized in the same way as other activities that we all do. So what I'm pushing for is to tie this work on diversity and inclusion to our normal systems of rewards.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. I do not mean awards, I mean rewards, because many of us all are used to getting the plaque and mm-hmm. the $50 gift certificate mm-hmm. for this diversity work. No, that's not it. I'm talking about the reward system. So it counts for your promotion. It counts in your hiring.
Right.
It counts in your compensation, all this work. And when we do that, we will see this rapid change that we want to have.
That's an excellent point.
So, Hannah, you got an article coming out in the medical journal Circulation this month. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. This is switching back again to my research and my science, where we've used this molecular test, it's called cell-free DNA, to diagnose acute rejection after heart transplantation. And the uniqueness about it is this: the work was done in transplant centers in the Washington, D.C. And Virginia area, where the population is high for African-American mm-hmm. patients. And when I went to NIH, I set up this consortium, and 43% of the patients that are reported in this study are African-American.
Wow.
You will not find that high representation of African-Americans in any research study, including the recent studies of the vaccine for COVID, or in any transplant study. So I'm very excited about it.
As you should
but
be.
Here's the downside. The African-American patients don't do as well after they've had their heart transplant. They have more rejection.
Right.
Hmm.
And so what is exciting is that now we have these molecular tools. I'm embarking on a new set of experiments and studies to figure out why do African-Americans reject their transplanted organs. And this is the case not only for heart transplants, but for lung transplant, kidney transplant, liver transplant. And I think we can find a genomic explanation that can lead to new medications, new therapies to prevent this rejection for heart transplant and other transplant patients.
That's
the excitement.
Yeah.
Of this new paper coming out.
And, you know, what has excited me today listening to you, I know that maybe it sounds as though we've gone to two terribly extreme topics, gender equity in institutions, back to, you know, life-saving research. But what I really have taken away is the question that, you know, Christy and I put out all the time. What will be different when women are in roles of leadership? And, you know, the proverbial 100 points of light. You have answered it so many ways throughout this conversation. So I want to ask the question, though, in that vein. What advice would you give your daughter, who a little bird told us, one of whom is actually following in your footsteps as a physician scientist? What are those conversations like?
This is really important. I give the advice to my daughters to really stick with what they love doing and to absolutely resist being pigeonholed, being stereotyped, put in a certain box, and to push forward with what it is that they love to do, getting the confidence and the knowledge to be able to do it, and the knowledge specifically that they are as good as any other person doing this work, including men. And in fact, I give the message that they are highly likely to be even more effective than a man because they have faced these challenges. So as women, because we have faced these challenges throughout our careers and our lives, we are just have more resilience. And there's a whole body of research on resilience that teaches us that we are just more equipped, having gone through all of this, to do a fantastic job. So, but there are these distractions, and these distractions come in the form of being stereotyped and put in boxes. And my advice is to all of the young people, resist. Do not go in that box.
I love it. But, you know, normally at this point in our conversation, Hannah, Christy would ask the question, what are you going to be hopeful for? And I think with the answer on resilience and you and the future of your daughters, you've given us that feeling. So, Dr. Hannah Valentine, thank you so much for joining us.
Hannah Valentine is a cardiologist and physician scientist at Stanford University. I'm Christy Atwater.
And I'm Andrea Gigline, and this is Hey Boss Lady.